9 p.m., there will be music. The old steeple is located at 246 Birding Street. For more information, their number is 707-786-7030, and the website is ferndalemusiccompany.com. A wetlands guided walk at the Samoa Dunes, May 20th, Saturday. Arcata, visit this ecologically diverse property 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. free. Reservations required. Contact Friends of the Dunes at 707-444-1397 or info@friendsofthedunes.com. Saturday, May 20th, Arcata Bike Rodeo. Help kids practice bicycle transportation safety. Free safety inspections, activities, and more. Creamery District, 1251 9th Street, Arcata, 10 a.m. till noon. The second annual Redwood Coast Kite Festival is planned for May 20th and 21st in collaborative efforts with artists and galleries associated with the Ink People. Kites as art installations are being displayed in Old Town Eureka. Watch kites and bring your own to the fun fly time. Kite building workshop 2, Halverton Park, 1st Street at Eureka Waterfront. That's 1st Street at Eureka Waterfront, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Info at 707-444-8946. And we are ready for Eric to come on with first his theme song. There we go.
Come on and take a walk with me through this green and growing land. Walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand. Walk through the valleys and the rivers and the plains. Walk through the sun and walk through the rain. Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all. From Colorado, Kansas, and the Carolinas too, Virginia and Alaska, from the old to the new, Texas and Ohio and the California shore. Tell me who could ask for more? Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all. Yet she's only as rich as the poorest of the poor, only as free as a padlocked prison door, only as strong as our love for this land, only as tall as we stand. For here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all. Come on and take a walk with me through this green and growing land. Walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand. Walk through the valleys and the rivers and the plains. Walk through the sun and walk through the rain. Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all, on us all.
That's right, it's time for All Things Reconsidered with your host, Eric Kirk. And the views and opinions expressed through the broadcast day are those of the speakers, not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or underwriters. Time will be made available for other viewpoints. Thank you for joining us. And hey, Eric, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Doing good. Glad to see you. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Tanya. All right, you're listening to All Things Reconsidered. As Tanya says, my name is Eric Kirk, and we're going to discuss some of the news of the day. I'm going to put out a few topics, but I actually was recently, I, of course, as you know, if you listen to my show, I am a history, amateur history buff, mostly political history. And I think yesterday we had, I think it was the 24th or 25th, pardon me, the 54th or 55th anniversary of the Catonville Nine action. Those of you who may remember, this was a group of Catholic activists against the war in Vietnam. I wouldn't say they were led. There was a group of them acting, but Father Daniel Berrigan is probably the most famous among them. And they went into the Catonville Draft Board, Center, and grabbed a bunch of draft files and burned them with homemade napalm, I think, that they made out of soap shavings and gasoline. I guess that works. I haven't wanted to mess with it to know for sure. But they did this. And, of course, at the time, the media was very much outraged, thought this was, you know, equivalent to an act of terrorism. And Father Daniel Berrigan famously said, "Apologies, good friends. I'm sorry that I burned paper instead of babies." I don't know exactly how he said it, but it was, or burned paper instead of children. I bring it up because it's a topic I've discussed on this show before, and something I'd like to have callers call in, because this is, my show is primarily about discussion. I don't do as much news or, you know, interviews as other shows do. The idea behind my show is to engage discussion with listeners. That's how I see the Thursday night talk format, kind of AM, kind of like the AM format that's going out of style, mostly right-wing radio. And I've always felt like we should have these discussions in more progressive settings to maybe take things a little bit deeper. And one of the topics I have long been interested in is people out there who have had religious upbringings, whether Christian, Jewish, or other. I've been always been fascinated as to how that may motivate your political views or your social views, even if you no longer are practicing of that religion. Which is kind of interesting, because I wasn't raised in a religious family setting. My mother had been raised Catholic. She was actually going to Seattle University to be a nun and decided she didn't want to do that, and actually left the church. On my father's side, there was no Christian or any type of what I would call supernatural religion at all. They were actually Communist Party members, my grandfather and step-grandmother and a bunch of people on my father's side. And so my mother kind of left the Catholic Church and became agnostic. My father had a lot of the same attitudes about his upbringing within the Communist Party. And in fact, he and my grandfather, my grandfather unfortunately passed away the year I was born, actually, while I was in utero. Unfortunately, he was a heavy drinker and died of liver failure. But he and my father had arguments, philosophical arguments that are classic of the old left versus the new left. And for those of you who understand, know the history, the old left were the communist and socialist left that was basically came up maybe following the Soviet Revolution and during the Depression, and focused on Marxism and structuralism in its way of thinking. The new left was a bit different. That's what came out in the 60s, and it focused on cultural issues as well as political issues, and tried to integrate cultural resistance as a part of it, rather than just simply structural. And I'm oversimplifying it to the max, because there was cultural resistance in the old left too, and there is a lot of structuralism in the new left. But there were some different aspects of the ideologies. Unfortunately, I was not alive to hear the arguments, but I did hear people from my grandfather's generation in discussions with my father and my mother and the younger generation at the time. And what I noticed was that anytime somebody disagreed, I was about 4 years old, and I noticed that whenever somebody disagreed with somebody else, they referred to the other person's arguments as bourgeois. Until I was about five, I would have thought that bourgeois was French for stupid, because anytime anybody disagreed, they said, "That's bourgeois." And I just figured, oh, that means that's stupid, which in a way it did. That's kind of because that's how they use the word. But my grandfather, I guess, in one argument, told my father, ecology is a bourgeois science. He rejected later, and of course, my father's response was, first of all, it's not called ecology anymore, Dad. It's called environmentalism. And when you think about environmentalism, it's actually more radical than Marxism ever even tried to be. And when you talk about getting to the literal roots of problems, that was sort of the context. And so I was raised with my step-grandfather, my aunts and uncles and the rest arguing over these types of issues. And if I was raised with any type of religion, that was it. And like a lot of Catholics who go to college and become kind of, agnostic about it and maybe respect their upbringing because it did establish some of their values, but maybe give up some of the more what they would call magical thinking. I kind of was that way too, only I kind of went in the other direction. When I went to college, I met a woman who was very deeply Catholic and also very, very deeply left-wing. And I'd been through some experiences. I became politically active when I was in high school, and I'm not going to go into the details, but I was actually kind of jaded and burned out by the time I went to college. I'm like 18 years old, and I'm already ready to quit politics, right, just because of experiences I had. And I really didn't think, philosophically, I just didn't think that politics could ever really transform the world, transform and make the world into a better place. And I sort of lost my faith in that. Because of some things I witnessed within the movement, so people within themselves, you know, supposedly trying to be progressive but they weren't being kind to each other. They're calling for this kind universe, but they couldn't be kind to each other. They were actually cruel to each other in many ways. And it's not like religion gets you away from that. There are plenty of people within the different churches that are also cruel to each other, and they justify it. I mean, you know, it was the line from Winton Soldier, you know, cheat a neighbor, you know, rob a friend. It'll be do it in the name of heaven, it'll be justified in the end. You always can find excuses for what you're doing. I went into kind of a, I don't want to call it nihilist, because nihilism actually is a very specific philosophy that I think is misunderstood, using the popular term of nihilism, I started to get into the belief that there really was nothing to the universe, that life was just an accident in the universe, human life was a joke, and you know, we're all going to die at some point anyway. And there was really, society was something that was created out of, a survival of the fittest. When you really got down to the core of it, we were all just predators, and we would turn on each other in a minute if the situation got rough. And certainly enough, I had encountered and read about enough situations where I had justification for that. And I met a woman who was deeply Catholic, and I expected her to argue with me. We went out on a couple of dates. I expected her to disagree and say, no, we're not predatory. We have, you know, we are in God's image and blah, blah, blah. We're called upon to love each other. She says, no, I actually do agree that is what's underneath all of our, of the social aspects that we are raised and how we define ourselves. But I believe there's actually something deeper, even further underneath that links us together. that underneath the predatory phase, that yes, there is this sort of animal side to us that does turn on each other, but that there is at its core something even deeper than that. And I refer to that as God. Other people may have a different way of seeing something. And it just was actually one of the most beautiful things I needed to hear at that time. And I actually flirted with Catholicism for a few years there. I mean, you know, most people go to college and they dump Catholicism, right? And they experiment with Eastern religions or other things. I experimented with Catholicism because of this woman whom, you know, I still know, she's still a friend. And it that made complete sense to me, that there, you know, is this connection. And she said, I don't even really have to have faith on it, because if you're right that we're all predators, we shouldn't have survived this long with all the weapons that we've created to kill ourselves off. We should have died by this point. And that's when I learned about the Catonville 9 protests and then started to really look at Martin Luther King and other people who were religiously motivated. And I started to actually think, well, maybe I should look into becoming Catholic. But, you know, the problem with that is you actually have to believe in God first. You know, you can't really convert to Catholicism if you don't believe in God. And I just, even though I'd softened in my atheism, I wasn't ready for an image of a, you know, old guy with a beard running, micromanaging the universe, right? It just didn't fit into my concept of any of the universe. But I had some experiences. I'm not going to go into the detail. They weren't supernatural experiences or miracles. They're just some really interesting coincidences that made me start to wonder. And I actually did attempt prayer. I was like, okay, well, there's a miracle. I'm trying to pray, right? You know, and actually, I even brought home rosary beads. And my mother, who had been raised in the Catholic Church, found them when I was home for summer one time, and she holds it. And I'd swear, if I was like in a normal family, the way she was holding those rosary beads, it would have been as she found a bong or something, right? So she looked at me and says, "What is this?" And I'm like, "Mom, you know what that is. You were raised in this." Yes, I was raised in it, in this. Why is this in my house, right? And I'm like, because she had a really negative experience by that time with the church. And I said, "Well, I'm trying different things on." I didn't say it that way, but I said, you know, I've met Kira. You've met Kira. I'm just checking it out. And she says, "You know, I did you a disservice. I should have sent you to catechism. When we were kids, just like your grandmother wanted me to, you know, because right now you're at college and you're getting these refined views of the church, Thomas Merton and liberation theology. And that's not what the church is. The church is boring crap that will, you know, do you. If you were raised with what I was raised with, you wouldn't go near a church, even on campus, you know." And I'm like, saying, "Okay, Mom, whatever." She says, no. And there was a point where she had been concerned because I wasn't dating women for a while. I was wondering if, you know, celibacy was the right thing. And she actually was wondering if I was gay, a little bit of a homophobic thing there, saying, you know, concerned that I was. And then she says, "Now I wish you were gay." Says, "This must be, if there is a God, I'm being punished for my homophobia," right? You know, I mean, I'm just like, okay, Mom, you're really being dramatic. But this was again the context in which I did. But the other thing I really noticed, and I will bring callers into this in a minute. I want to wrap this up. Is that I attended demonstrations that were organized by the religious left, what I would call the religious left, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Catholic Worker, and the Clergy and Lady Concerned, all that came out of kind of the new left. And I found I actually preferred their demonstrations. They would do they would go outside San Quentin and do candlelight vigils. And rather than yelling slogans that rhymed or sometimes didn't even bother to rhyme, they sang songs, they prayed, and it was a softer type thing, with it felt like more humility to it. And it felt more effective. I don't know if it was more effective. It just felt like it should be more effective in reaching people. And it felt like it was more grounded in a desire, because one of the things that the religious left would focus on that the secular left didn't was how we can be a better person in addition to creating a movement. To the side, they didn't distinguish between the two. You would have the more conservative Christians say, "No, it's all about my salvation, and I'm going to try to be a better person." And then you'd have the secular left saying, "It's about building a better society." And it seemed like the religious left, as I became to know them, didn't separate the two. Yes, we need to work on ourselves to become better people, and yes, we need to work on that collectively to become better people. And so there's a term, cultural Jew, to refer to somebody who was raised Jewish but doesn't believe in God or isn't part of the religion. They're cultural Jewish. Maybe I'm culturally Catholic. I don't know. I don't adhere to the faith. I did try to pray, and it just nothing ever set in. I even tried looked into some Protestant Protestant denominations and thought, and even did my thesis on the rise of fundamentalist Christianity and its political influence in this country. And I do have great respect for people of the faith, even though I don't see the universe in the same way they do. I'm going to bring in the callers here. You're listening to KMUD. This is All Things Reconsidered. And I'm raising the issue of how has it affected your outlook, your social outlook on life? And the phone number, if you want to join, is 707-923-3911. And Tanya, it looks like you wanted to say something, but maybe we take the caller first? Or do we have a caller? Okay, we'll take the caller. And then I'd love to hear what you have to say, Tanya.
Story never ends.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello, is this Eric?
It is Eric, yes.
Hi, Eric. This is Saj. You know, you have a kind of similar but strangely coinciding story to mine. And that is that when my dad, got out of World War II, he went into World War II when he was 16. And he met my mother at a very progressive college on the GI Bill down in Florida called Rollins College. Uh-huh. And Rollins College is where Mr. Rogers emerged from, that great little elementary guy that was on TV, the Mr. Rogers guy. And he had a gay student union there at Rollins College. Uh-huh. And it was quite liberal college. And my mother was the only daughter of an Italian immigrant from Massachusetts. And all three of her brothers emerged from World War II alive. But she was the only one that stayed home from World War II. And at 17, she announced to her father, "I'm going to college, to the progressive college in Florida, Dad. And I'm taking a train down there." And he goes, "Oh, of course, dear, you can do whatever you want." And then she met my dad outside an infirmary window when she contacted chickenpox as a freshman in college. And my dad thought it was a riot. And he, busted her right out of the infirmary and told her, "Stop scratching your chickenpox." Mm-hmm. And, that's how the relationship started. But, she was 17 and he was a World War II vet. So, he became a lawyer, chief public defender in two counties in Boston, and went on to have five children, of which I'm the second one. And, I went through several crazy things with Catholicism. Uh-huh. Being that I was a freshman at Catholic University in 1972, I attended the last Vietnam demonstrations against our government there on my bicycle down East Capitol Street, watching the entire town burn to the ground. That was quite shocking to me as a freshman in college. And then some of my friends had biracial marriages. But I wasn't that shocked. I was living in a city with 99.9% black people at the time, and I was living in the ghetto side of the city.
So tell me, what were your...
I lived in Georgetown, and I used to drive my bicycle over there right through the ghetto. I had no problem driving my 10-speed bike all the way through Washington, D.C., but the national crime of the Immaculate Decepticon that we noticed was the richest building on campus. We used to make fun of that because we realized that, you know, the Catholic Church was full of repression and guilt, and we didn't like it. We knew better than that. When the nuns told us we couldn't leave the dormitories and the guys could stay out till 12 and we had to be home at 10:30, that was sexism. Abortion passed in 1972. We thought that was great. All we think now is it's recidivistically sad, all the things that are going on in this country, and I'll let you take it from there. Raise up the ire. Bye.
All right. Okay. Well, that was quite a story. Tanya, you had some thoughts.
Well, first, let me thank Saj for being candid and eloquent and weaving in some interesting details there from history, too. I mean, this lifetime...
And she comes from an academic background, by the way. She's got her family is very interesting. But
yeah.
Another time.
And, you know, speaking from my perspective in this lifetime, I didn't witness the civil rights era. I think that actually would have deepened my faith, if you want to explore faith at all. But I think this conversation you've opened and broached this evening is really fascinating, Eric, because it's so interesting to think, like, how do religious beliefs impede or impair people with the religion? And then how is that affecting us humans in our beliefs about each other, too? There's another call coming in, but I'd love to comment again later.
I'm sure we'll have time.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tanya. All right, let's take the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
You are on the air, caller.
Are you there? Well,
they can call again.
All right, come on. Yeah, that's 923-3911. If you want to join the conversation, just please call back in. So you were saying, Tanya.
Thank you, Eric. I really appreciate it. Well, I want to mention something that's been really life-changing for me as a person that was not raised religiously, and I was given the open door option from my parents. They said, if you want to practice a religion, if you want to go to church, tell us and we'll take you. And then I ended up going to one Presbyterian church for a while with one of my friends, not until I was the age of 11. So the first 10 years of my life, I had no indoctrination. I only visited a couple of churches. And then later, I found that I really identified with Buddhism. Mm-hmm. I am half Jewish, and I was not raised Jewish, notably. Right. But I identified with Buddhism. Then later, I found this practice in the Tibetan tradition that's passed down from Chögyam Trungpa through Pema Chodron, and Pema Chodron is now one of the top teachers of Buddhism in the world, when she was never Buddhist until her 40s.
Sure.
She shares Maitri practice, where if you have someone you feel like you have an enemy relationship, if someone you have opposition with, you have conflict, well, the practice is first visualizing someone that you love, that you have like an open connection of love, there's no negative there, you visualize them, you think about the love for them. You wish for them the root of joy. You wish for them to understand the root of suffering and to reduce suffering. Then you shift that to someone you don't even know. You could think about someone you just saw on the street. You could think someone who walked in where you work and you don't even know them. And you could send them then the same love. Think about it. Send them the same love that you really deeply love someone else. And then someone, perfect stranger, give them the same compassion and love, like free for all, hey, I love you in the same way. Then the third part of the practice is with the enemy. And you think and you visualize them and all these hot, uncomfortable, deep emotions come up. And you really suck all that in, breathe it out, and wish them love. Wish them to end the suffering, to feel joy. And I have practiced this with people that I had real conflict with. And then come back to the room with them and there was no more conflict because they could sense my love. So it's part of the compassion practice. I just wanted to mention that because you had talked about, like, what is our essential nature? Is it nasty, brutish, and short, you know, as Thomas Hobbes wrote? Or what? And is it through religious practice of practicing these arts of love or service or whatever it is? I just wanted to add that to the mix because you totally opened up my vision of, like, what is it? Do we inherit these feelings where we feel that people are against us and we're against them? Or can we open our minds to see that we can be here together in community?
No, definitely, Tanya. And it's interesting. What attracted you to that particular strain of Buddhism? Anything in particular?
You know, I don't know what it was for me in hearing Pema Chodron. If our listeners have ever checked her out, I mean, something about her teachings I immediately started connecting with in my early 20s once I encountered her writings. And I had never been able to meditate before. Other, you know, spoiler alert on meditation. My mom is a yogin since she was 19 years old. She's been practicing the art of meditation and stuff. And she never taught me, ever. So then I tuned into that meditation had value, and Pema Chodron explained it to me. She's an American. She was raised in this society. She found meditation in her 40s, and she described it like you're sitting on a mountain and you allow the clouds of your thoughts to part and see the clear sky. Each thought, remind yourself you're thinking. Just remind yourself you're thinking. And that was the key for me to unlock the thinking and be able to see it as such and detach. And then I had a deeper depth when I read the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita describes the seer, that within us, each of us is a witness to all of our experiences. There's different speculation on this. Like Carl Jung, the psychologist, sees that witness as a collective unconscious. We're all aware with the same awareness, in addition to our individual ego mind that, you know, Freud first established. But if we can tune into that energy between all of us, too, I don't know, there's just so many places that your conversation today has brought me to thinking about, Eric.
It did. I mean, as I said, I did not become Catholic or Christian, but there is the basic Lord's Prayer, and in it you say, "Forgive me my trespasses, as I forgive those who trespass against me," or something like that. I've got it mixed up, but it's the concept of forgiveness, when you think about it, is a radical concept. I mean, it's not something that you think would come naturally. You know, why? If we are in this Hobbesian world where really it is just a jungle out there, unless we've got a dictator over us telling us what to do, then there is no point to forgiveness. It's weakness, right? But it is put forth as a form of strength, what binds us together. And you know, I mean, even as I started to think in terms of science, because a woman I was dating she went on to become a veterinarian. She's very science oriented. Is saying biologically, if you forget about God for a minute, if we were to survive, we survived, you know, we're not very fast. We're not the strongest animal. We're not, we have a hard time climbing trees even to get away with things. The only way we survived, and yes, we do have this frontal lobes that allow us to pick up weapons and things, but even picking up a stick really doesn't do all that much good against a leopard or a bear if you're by yourself. What allowed us to survive is the cooperation with other people, finding ways to get through all of these dangers working together. So it is actually inherent in the universe that we do learn how to forgive, because if you can't forgive, you're not going to be able to function with other people. And that is like the first thing to get lost when it breaks down in your anger is the difficulty forgiving. So when you're talking about, you know, putting your energy and thinking of your enemy, this trying to have the same feelings that you would for your friend as an exercise, I mean, that is it's a radical concept to do it, because it does not come naturally. And it looked like the light was ringing there, so I'm going to just remind everybody you're listening to KMUD. This is All Things Reconsidered. We are talking about whether you were raised with religion or have had some influence of religion, and how it influences your daily life and informs your politics. As I was pointing out, I was not raised with any kind of religion in the classic sense, in that I wasn't raised with God, you know, or that. I was raised, I would argue, spiritually, but that's a whole other story. But we do have a caller, and let's take that caller.
All right. Are you ready for Saj again?
Sure. Go ahead.
All right.
Challenge spots where I've had to rely on something that I call faith. And I don't mean on faith outside of me. I mean faith from within me. And I had to cultivate faith throughout my life through my experiencing of being a mother of a mentally ill son and being in and out of some very difficult relationships in my life. And when I was a young child, I remember asking my very Catholic mother, what is faith? And she just looked at me like she could not explain it. And she said, someday you will know what faith is. And I just accepted it. And now I actually do know what faith is. And faith is like if you find yourself in a calamitous experience and you even think you might die, you still maintain your faith and you end up alive. And it's happened to me several times, and I call them near-death experiences. Faith mm-hmm. will bring you through more than you can ever believe. If you contact faith, you'll know what it is. Goodbye.
Saj, thank you very much. Thank you for that. All right, we may have another caller. We'll give that another minute to see. But, like I said, I encountered people of a lot of different faiths. If you're in the Bay Area and you're politically active, you're going to meet people of different faiths and different traditions being active. And, you know, this notion that there is a notion out there that to be Christian, you've got to be conservative, and to be conservative, you've got to be Christian in a certain way. But the vast majority of people who are quote unquote left wing are not atheists, because there are really only about maybe 5% of the population who identify as atheists, maybe another 5% as agnostic. And the left was a lot bigger than that. And, we really do need to learn how to become inclusive, more inclusive and accepting. And sometimes it means it maybe takes them in a different ideological direction than us, but we've learned how to work with it. But it looks like we have another caller, so let me take that call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello again, Eric. We have no other caller at this moment.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
We just had a little comment there after Saj joined us again. But do you want more thoughts?
Sure, please.
Yeah. It's just such a huge topic. And like, what angle do we go at it from our individual experience? You know, each of us, it's like every day, what are your thoughts when you wake up? And what do you do with them? And what are your thoughts when you go to sleep? And this is a new practice I've been exploring. What if before I go to sleep, I do affirmations and focusing on the things I'm grateful for, the things that are going well, my goals, and focus on that, something that feels really good, versus the thinking of like, oh, that didn't go well with that person. Oh, no, this is hugely challenging. Oh, I don't have an answer for that. Like that stuff, you go to sleep with that, and then your subconscious wakes up with a different energy. Then if you go to sleep with positive feeling, waking up into it's a new day. And even that is a practice and like a belief, like it's a new day, I'm made new. Or I don't know, there's just so many aspects of it. You have background in Catholicism, which I don't really have, but I do see that mm-hmm. Catholicism comes from Christianity. I also see that Christianity comes from Judaism.
Yeah.
And that Christ might have studied in India. So it's like...
Possibly. We don't... Yeah, yeah.
So like...
Know, but it,
yeah.
And we know he went east. I do know I had a religious studies professor, anybody who went to Santa Cruz, in fact, Biana, who just left, would remember his name was Noel King. He used to refer to Judaism, Islam, and Christianity as the mother and two daughters. I mean, it's all part of the monotheism. And a lot of times we tend to look down on monotheism, but it's actually... different. It can be different from what we think, and the rest. Is Christianity really monotheist when it's got the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit? Right. I mean, that's the Jews and Muslims both question that. But you know, they come from the same roots, and they've got a lot of the same thing. Collectively, the three are Western religion, and it's got its limitations, but it also has a lot of beauty in it. And you, for every you know, pogrom and horrible thing like the Inquisition and everything you come up with. You also have societies, lay societies that have been created throughout, and the initial Christian societies, which upon which some socialism is based, and again, activism going back to when the Jesuits took a stand against the Portuguese slave trade and actually took up guns to help the Guanari resist the Portuguese slave traders in what is now Brazil, 18th century. Jesuit, I mean, you know, and we can take it from so many angles. The Jesuits originally were created to be the intellectual soldiers of the church. They were supposed to take in the heretical ideas, learn about them, so that they can determine so that they could combat them. I think it's Saint Ignatius is what the order is based on to fight them. The problem with that model is that the problem with that model is that when you expose intelligent people to heretical ideas, sometimes they're influenced by them. And so the Jesuits, which were created to combat to be the counter reformation and the counter renaissance, ended up there was actually an attempt to actually disband them, crush them, and even kill off their priesthood at different times because they took stands against slavery. And in fact, some of the Catholic left are Jesuits. I believe both Daniel and Philip Berrigan were Jesuits. I could be wrong. Robert McSorley, who wrote a great book on peacemaking and Christian pacifism, was a Jesuit. I mean, different aspects of liberation theology come from the Jesuit practice. So you've got, but that's not to say all Jesuits are left-wing, by the way, or progressive. There are some reactionary Jesuits too, but it could take you in different directions when you take that upon yourself. It's a fascinating history, and I strongly recommend, if you're not familiar with the history of that particular, I guess you call it an order, I'm not sure, but a great movie came out in the 80s called The Mission, that was about the Jesuits fighting with the Guanari to resist the European slave trade. And that's back, you know, before Martin Luther King. I don't want to say Martin Luther was necessarily a progressive figure in a lot of ways, but in terms of anti-authoritarianism, there's a lot of beauty and a lot of in the history of it. And like I said, I just it didn't resonate with who I was and what my personal history was. But again, if you want to join the conversation, the phone number is 707-923-3911. What faith were you raised in, if it's different from what it is now? And what are your thoughts about how that faith and being raised in it informed who you are, even if you're not no longer part of that faith? We've had this discussion before, and we've discussed different angles, discussed it from different angles, but I'm kind of going broad at this point, just on celebrating this anniversary. Well, actually, yesterday was the anniversary of the Catonville 9 action, which is pretty significant. Daniel Berrigan, I think, just passed away recently. Philip Berrigan was also a priest. He got defrocked because he and Elizabeth McAllister got married. She was a nun. I think they both got excommunicated. I met Elizabeth McAllister one time. She spoke. Very interesting woman, hardcore feminist, anti-abortion. Not anti-choice, but anti-abortion. She believed it was not the correct individual decision to make, but she did not believe that the state had any business making it for women. Very interesting points, and just said, you know, that this would be her personal decision. Hard to come to. All right, we have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, Eric. So I'm just calling. You brought up the movie The Mission. Wasn't that with Robert De Niro?
Robert De Niro and what's his name, who was the voice of the villain in
Jeremy
Lion
Irons.
King? Jeremy Irons, yeah. Yes, excellent movie.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. That was a great movie. I need to watch the movie again now that you mentioned it.
The only thing I didn't understand about it was why they let the Portuguese up the waterfall. I mean, they were at the top of the cliff there. Apparently, that's the only way to get up on that plateau is to climb through the waterfall. Ridiculous. But why they weren't standing at the top dropping rocks down on them the whole time. But anyway, that's the thing about movies.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you on that one. Another great movie, people never watched it, of course, is Last Testament of Christ. You know, William Dafoe's haunting portrayal of Jesus. One of the best acting performances I think I've ever seen. Just very interesting take on the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And, my personal experience was I went to an Episcopalian private school up until I went into high school.
Episcopalianism being Catholic light, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It was pretty much Catholic light. You got it. You know, the Mass was pretty much like the Catholic Mass mostly. And, I haven't been in a church. I can't remember the last time I've been inside a church. I'm and not religious these days. But I had an overall positive experience with Episcopalianism. And, you know, they, after all, were one of the first denominations that, you know, was, you know, willing to accept gay marriage. And I think they deserve a lot of credit for that.
Yes, and they also were one of the first major denomination to ordain women.
That's right. Correct. Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, why the Catholic Church can't follow suit, I don't know. Why it would solve so many of their church's problems if they would simply allow women to become priests.
And allow the priests to get married.
Yeah, priests to get married. Just like they used to, the first 7 or 8 centuries of the Catholic Church, priests could get married, and they decided at some point, wait, if we don't allow priests to have families, then when the priests die, their property goes back to the church. And that was basically the impetus for them banning marriage by priests, was so that the church would inherit their wealth. And at that point in time in history, during the Dark Ages is what it was called at the time, priests were often, you know, some of the most wealthy people in town. So, yeah, that's what it was all about. It wasn't about, you know, what the Bible had to say. It was simply a political choice and an economic choice on part of the church leadership that they need to go ahead and change right about now, I would say. But one thing I like I got to also get real on the church. Overall, Christianity, if you look at the number of Americans who self-identify as Christians, it has dropped dramatically in the past 20 years. I remember after 9/11, all the far-right politicians and the televangelists, you know, saying they thought this was going to be the time for America to go full-blown Christian. And what actually happened was the reverse. America became significantly less Christian as a result of the war on terror, because we saw the hypocrisy of those policies. And, thinking that, you know, murder and warfare is somehow Christian. No, I'm sorry, Jesus would not approve. So the far right, they really are doing a great job, not only in making fewer Americans Christian, but seeing to it that the younger folks especially, they don't even necessarily have an open mind on the subject at this point. They're going to be quite agnostic, to say the least. In future years.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And the Episcopalian Church is considered one of the more liberal denominations, and it's got a lot of beautiful stuff that comes out of it. But you got to remember, in England, I believe it's called the Anglican Church, also throughout Africa. I mean, this is the church that was created because the Catholic Church wouldn't give Henry VIII a divorce, right? So, there's a little bit of reason to be cynical there, but it's turned into something very interesting. And you're right, religion in general, at least in the classical sense, is on the decline in the United States. It had been in Europe for decades, and it just took a while for the United States to kind of start catching up with that.
In Europe, I mean, it's almost, the cultural Christianity portion of European civilization is dwindling. And in America, we're going to pretty much be headed down the same road. And I hate to say it, but, you know, those fundamentalists like you were speaking of earlier that you did your thesis on, those folks, they're the ones to blame. They want to blame the liberals and Jews, specifically. They love blaming Jews for everything, don't they? George Soros specifically. But what it really is it's their fault for having made their brand of Christianity, which is quite strange often, very unpalatable for a lot of Americans. Right. You know, because when you're rooting for Armageddon, when you're rooting for the destruction of the planet and the human species, Yeah, most people are not going to be in favor of that. Sorry, you know.
No, good point. Completely. All right. Well, thank you very much. You know, for those thoughts. And yeah, the Episcopalian Church is one of those churches that you'll see very much involve signing letters against the nuclear arms race and a lot. And they were very much involved, quite a few of them, against the war. If it, clergy and lady concerned against the war, you'd see ministers, a lot of them inspired by the civil rights movement, in which a lot of ministers were called to go down and witness. They particularly needed to get white people down there so to see if there would be less violence. Sometimes that worked, sometimes it didn't. And so out of that came a whole different understanding of Christianity than was being presented. That doesn't mean there's always been a social gospel. I mean, always from the beginning, there's always been a social gospel, even in this country, for a long time. And people didn't necessarily distinguish again between individual salvation and social. And, it was different. And yes, I did my thesis on fundamentalism, and in the 10 minutes I have left, I'm not going to try to go into all of it, but I was fascinated as to how somebody could adopt that mindset. What would make somebody do that? Why would somebody who wasn't raised in it particularly be attracted to it? Because you get people who are converted to it that show up to these meetings in search of something, and then all of a sudden they're made a part of it. I do think that that a lot of us in the movement, the left, could learn something from them, because when you show up to one of their churches, they're right on top of you, inviting you to for meals and all of that. We might want to, you know, I've always thought that we could think about being a little bit more inviting to newcomers into our midst. That's something they do, because if you're feeling lost and you walk and you wander into a Chautauqua tent of fundamentalists, it's not because you're stupid. Cult members actually depend on people who are very smart. And that's something to realize. There is a good side of religious faith, and there can be downsides. And cultism is obviously the flip side, and also reductionist thinking, where everything is black and white, this or that, good or evil. And anyway, I could ramble on. Tanya, you had something else you wanted to say.
Well, that was very intuitive of you, Eric, actually, because I didn't have my hand raised here in Zoom, but I was just thinking about something else, because I had said before, what about faith? I want to get back to faith. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't raised to be a Jew, although I am 50% pure blood, mm-hmm. which is because my father was intimidated, teased, and beaten by other Americans because he was identified as Jewish. Yeah. And so he, as a young person, decided not to become a Jew, which is beyond depressing to me to think about.
Can I ask what part of the country he was raised
in? In Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
So being now identifying myself as a Jewish American, a Jewish German American, and yet not knowing and not being taught, my grandmother dying in quick enough time in my adulthood, I couldn't possibly download from her, you know, all the Yiddish and all the songs and all the stories and all the meaning. So I've been trying to pick it up in stride. And what I've noticed is there is a real parallel between some of the other things I was also taught to believe in, a different aspect of philosophy, where, like, philosophically, even logically, is a mathematician. I want to tie it into science and practice of all kinds of things. You call it religion, but mm-hmm. is it religion or is it a practice of belief? Like, if sure. we believe as a scientist, I need to prove this through a methodology, X and Y and Z, then, if it's a mathematician and they say, okay, the function must equal, that's still a belief. And if mm-hmm. my belief is I'm going to pray, and you mentioned prayer earlier too, I'm going to pray, sure. and then I'm going to tie this back to Judaism. What I did learn about Judaism is it starts with Genesis, where, like, the word, the thought that we first have before we speak a word, creates reality. And that's the story in Genesis, is an example of what is actually hearkening back to the Jewish tradition and Jewish mysticism. If I bring right. that through in prayer, full circle, if I'm thinking something, I'm hoping it becomes real, and I speak it aloud. This is a key to prayer I only discovered recently. If I speak my prayers aloud and I say to the creative force in me and the world, I hope that this happens with conviction, belief in my mind, through my words, I can witness it happen. I can witness it come to pass. And then I wonder about time. What is time? Is time real? Is it part of this belief? Or is it through? There's so many questions that it brings me.
Sure.
What do you think, Eric, about
it? Well, see, that was what brought me to really thinking about it was, you know, that sort of pulled me away from what I would consider to be the classic atheist position that this is material, that we have this material universe and we just take for granted that it's there, is the fact that anything exists at all is just an incredible miracle. It's insane when you think about it, that anything exists at all. Now, that, you know, that's a lot of jumps to any type of particular religion or religious thought. But the fact that something actually, that anything exists, that we have this, and then that we have this, this universe that it has a lot of dirt and fire and dust, that all of a sudden things crawl up out of it that are animated, such as animals, plants, and the like. It's just, I guess it's sort of like the cosmological argument in a sense. It doesn't tell me that there's a God necessarily. It just tells me there's more to the universe than what we see, taste, feel, hear, and or whatever else I left out, smell, I guess. But do we have one more caller? All right, caller.
Hello.
You're on the air. Hi.
I wanted to comment on the current Pope. He's a Jesuit. And he left from being a chemist to be a Jesuit and progressive as far as popes go. And he's in his late 80s now. He's got to get some more cardinals nominated so he can get another pope like him. But
before he dies,
I grew up around the Catholic workers.
Dorothy Day and Paul Morin, Peter Morin.
Yeah, and the liberation theology. Yeah. And this current pope wants to make a Archbishop Oscar Romero from El Salvador, who was murdered stopping the war there. And so this in the last 10 years has been the most progressive that the church has swung. He's had some opposition, though, by the right wing of the Catholic Church, and he's holding off on that as long as he can, hopefully for a few more years, and then get another pope in like him. Go ahead.
No, he's a little bit in the tradition of, what was it, the Second Vatican, who my mother insists must have been poisoned or something, but I don't know if that's true. But there was a lot of progressive ground made. Then we went 30 years with the guy from Poland, I'm forgetting his name, and he was very conservative. But now we have this guy who does seem to be moving the church in a different direction.
Yeah, the two previous popes, Benedict and the scholar, the conservative scholar, and then John Paul II was in for, you know, for 35 years, those two swung it to the right. And I think John Paul was traumatized by the occupation of Germany and Poland in the Second World War. He was there during that.
Right.
And so he tried to squash everything, including liberation, theology, et cetera. Yeah. And a lot of people left the church during that time.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. He did. He was firm on that. But thank you very much for the Catholic Worker. Everybody should look it up. You can get a copy of it. I think it's still a penny, even all the way since the Depression. I always give them a little bit more than that, but it's a great paper. Very, very religious, by the way. Very kind of religiously conservative in some ways, but radical in terms of what they proposed. Almost anarchist in a way.
Social work, the great social work. There's a book out by Martha Hennessy, who's the granddaughter of Dorothea Day, and it's about Dorothea Day and her mother, Martha Hennessy's mother.
Right.
And it's a great book. It talks about what they did, how they helped, and I lived in that part of the Bowery.
Why they chose the name Catholic Worker. It was named after the Daily Worker. It was going to be the Catholic alternative to the communist paper, Daily Worker.
Right.
So, very interesting.
Thanks.
All right, you bet. Thank you very much. We're at the top of the hour. I will take this up again, but this is, you know, definitely something I want to explore, and maybe in a more organized way in this, because I think it's really important. I do think that the politics where we're at, even left-wing politics to a certain degree, we've reached a point where there's disconnect between people. Part of it's the technology, I think, that we're using to communicate with each other. But also, I think we're in an age where connection is not the primary focus. And, and turn the other cheek, forget it. I mean, it just, nobody wants to hear that these days. So I want to revisit this. I'm always open to suggestions. You can as to particular ways to take this. And if you actually believe in some sort of creative mystical force that is independent of human beings, I want to know more about that. I want to know what you think about it or what you feel about it. Maybe it's not so much about what you think, but about how you feel. I just don't know. Anyways, we are at the top of the hour. Tanya, thank you very much. And thank you for joining the conversation and doing a great job engineering. And thank callers. I want to thank all of the callers. Every one of them were very thoughtful. Until next time, keep thinking.
Walk through the sun and walk through the rain. Here is a land full of power and glory. Beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all. From Colorado, Kansas.